Science Friday is supported by Progressive. Now, most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Science Friday is supported by Random House, publisher of When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi, a memoir from a doctor turned patient about the fragile beauty of our mortal lives. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is available at prh.com/air.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, a look at a new biometric technology for unlocking your phone using different parts of your body. I know you're going to want to listen to that. But first, if you were listening last week, we told you about how the 1919 solar eclipse served as a check on Einstein's ideas about gravity and helped make him a household name. Remember that? Well, this week, Einstein's theory of general relativity gets another boost with info on how stars orbit the center of our galaxy. Here to tell us more about that study and other selected short stories in science is Ryan Mandelbaum. He's a science writer with Gizmodo, and he's here in our CUNY studios. Welcome. First time.
First time, long time, as they say. I'm excited.
So let's talk about what part of Einstein's theories was this new research testing?
Right. So essentially what's happened is, you know, the laws of physics that you learn about in high school and Newton's laws work pretty much up until the scale of maybe a planet or a star, in which case corrections need to come in to account for the weirdness of gravity. Now, in the case of, you know, one of the original proofs of general relativity was Mercury's orbit actually precessed sort of like a spirogram around our own sun. Now, you can think of this almost like a way bigger test of that, because they wanted to know, okay, so if Einstein's theory of relativity fits up at this point, how big and how massive a scale does it continue to work? So what they did was they actually watched stars orbiting Sagittarius A star, which is a huge, massive thing in the center of our own galaxy, to see if their orbits actually, you know, kind of went along with the rules of general relativity.
And they had to mine a lot of data for this and look through a lot of stuff?
Oh, sure. It took about 2 decades worth of data about these three stars, including a lot of new data from the Very Large Telescope in Chile.
And so I guess it all worked out right for Einstein in this case.
So for now, it all worked
so
out right.
For now.
But so the error on it was basically there was a pretty big level of uncertainty on the results. So as of right now, they know that it's consistent with the theory of relativity, but more data might show up that there might need to be some new corrections.
It's amazing that, 100 years of testing out this stuff.
Yeah,
still, and they're still doing it.
It still works, is what I think is most exciting.
Yeah, well, that's the good news. There's speaking of news, there's news this week about a big salmon going on sale. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I wouldn't say it's big as much as I would say it's fast. It's the first genetically engineered salmon hit the market in Canada from a company called Aqua Bounty Technologies. Now, it's taken them 25 years to get this to the market, and really what's happening is that they've found a way to make salmon grow to be the same size as non-genetically modified salmon in about half the time.
Wow.
It costs about $5.3 US per pound. And they didn't say who bought it, but it is apparently on sale now in Canada.
So is it getting any pushback because it's a GMO salmon at all?
I think that the place where it's gotten the most pushback has been here in the United States. I mean, you might wonder why we didn't get the first genetically engineered salmon. I love salmon. But what's happened is that the FDA actually approved the salmon back in 2015, but an Alaskan senator basically said that there should be some program to tell customers that they're buying these genetically engineered salmon, and people have really been pushing back here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. So it's has it been approved yet by the, who needs to approve it?
So the FDA did approve it. But there's just been a lot of regulatory hurdles that have sort of prevented it from coming to market here.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to some news this week that you have about colon cancer rates in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. So basically, there's just something going on with colon cancer rates right now, and we just don't know why. What happened was that there was a study earlier this year that found that in folks younger than 50, there was an increase in the rates of colon cancer. But this new study in the Journal of the American Medical Association found that mortality from colon cancer was also increasing in this group. And what the reason that's important is because the original study, just increasing rates, could have meant that maybe more people were getting screened. And that's a good thing, right? But if more people are dying, then it actually paints sort of a bleaker picture and shows that maybe there's some cause that we don't quite know about.
How young are we talking about people here?
Yeah, so this is the rates increased 1% between for folks between 20 and 54 years old.
Wow, you would not think. You'd think it would go to the other direction, be older people.
Right, and it's not increasing in older people.
No one knows why.
Got to figure it out.
Finally, a huge dinosaur finally gets named. Now, I've seen at the American Museum of Natural History. They have a cast of it, and it's so big, its head has to stick out of the door of the exhibit area. Have you been to that one?
It's amazing. I mean, you want to take a selfie with it because it's just right there.
They dubbed it Titanosaur originally, but that's not a scientific name. They have now given it a scientific name.
Right, that's correct. So, I mean, what happened was way back in 2012, they found all of these bones in Argentina, and obviously the American Museum of Natural History needed to get on that and get a cast of this huge titanosaur. But now they're actually releasing the paper on these dinosaurs to really, you know, get that analysis of what they've found. And they've named it Patagotitan maiorum. Patago is for Patagonia, where they found it. Titan is obviously for the Titans, the Greek divinities. And then maiorum is actually named for the family, the Mayo family, who hosted the archaeologists during the excavation.
You mean the people who funded it. They host, I mean, they actually, with their house or somebody who paid for it, I guess.
That's just what it said, I don't remember.
But is it the biggest dinosaur? I mean, it's certainly one of the biggest, right? It was how much did it weigh? Or how
right,
was it
weighed 69 tons and it was 122 feet long. But while it is the biggest in size, it is not the heaviest animal because we know that the blue whale has it beat at around 3 times heavier, 200 tons. Yeah, it's big.
Well, this one won't be hanging from the ceiling like the blue whale, is it?
That's right, yeah.
Anytime soon. Thank you for taking the time to be with us today. Thank you, Ryan.
Yeah, thanks so much, Ira.
Well, Ryan Mandelbaum, he's a science writer with Gizmodo and talking about the news of science this week.
This is KERA
for WWNO,
St. Louis Public Radio,
Iowa Public Radio News.
That new kind of button sounds like it's time to check in on the state of science. It's a new segment where we're checking in with public radio stations around the nation to focus on local science news there, the science stories in your backyard. The first story involves something that we talked about back in February, the Oroville Dam in Northern California spilling over, heavy winter rains causing the reservoir to fill up and the massive amount of water collapsed the main spillway. So water was released into the never-been-used emergency spillway, and that sent water cascading down the hillside. And that was not a pretty sight because nearly 200,000 people were evacuated as a precaution. Now a closer look at the earthen dam has revealed something different, too, a mysterious grassy green spot in the soil. What does all of that mean? Dan Brecky is here to give us an update on the Oroville Dam. He's a transportation and infrastructure reporter for KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira.
Okay, first, let's go back a bit and give us a thumbnail sketch about the events. What do we know about what caused this spillover of the dam?
Well, you gave a pretty good summary of it, but what happened was that back on February 7th, a large breach appeared in this very large, 3,000-foot-long by about 180 feet wide concrete spillway, and that immediately created big concerns because the lake was rising because of these storms that you mentioned. And so after a few days of experimenting with different flows, the lake was getting higher, and eventually this emergency spillway flowed over. And there was unexpected, very severe erosion that threatened to collapse part of the emergency spillway structure, and that raised fears of essentially a wall of water racing down the Feather River and wiping out communities downstream. So people got about an hour to pack up and leave.
Mm-hmm. And the secondary spillway, did that alleviate the problem?
Well, it didn't, because the idea of a spillway, people have a structure in mind, and what was in place here was just a what they call a weir. It's an overflow structure. So water rises to that level and it goes pouring over. And the spillway, what they termed the spillway, was just a naked hillside covered with rocks and brush and soil. And the belief was, on the part of the dam owner, the California Department of Water Resources, that that wouldn't really cause serious erosion, but that proved not to be true.
So everything has been repaired, it's holding water now?
Well, we're in our dry season. They've drawn the lake way down, and it's going to be drawn down all the way through November and December. There's a massive construction project to get a new serviceable main spillway in place.
Right.
And
the
purpose, the state's intention is to never let that emergency spillway flow again.
Yeah.
But I don't know if nature cooperates with that plan.
Let's talk about this mysterious green spot that has appeared on the dam. There are different ideas about what this means. What's it made out of, the green spot?
Well, you know, on the surface, as you said, there's lush vegetation. And when we say spot, just to be clear, this is about a 2-acre area, so about the size of 2 football fields. And what's happened is that, you know, inspectors for a long time, at least 15 years, have been going, well, we have this lush vegetation. It's wet over here at certain times of year, but we don't really know where that water is coming from. And it turns out that if you go back into construction records, there's actually a picture from 1964 when the dam was being built of water pooled near, you know, what has become known as the green spot. So the big thing here is it's an unknown. And a couple years ago, 2014 actually, there is an important state federal dam safety review held every 5 years. And when that review was held, they said, listen, this is a high-profile historical issue that the Department of Water Resources, needs to find a conclusive answer to. Where is this water coming from? Mm-hmm. Because there are concerns that it could be threatening the integrity of the dam.
Wow. So we don't know what it is, and I understand there are 93 other dams in California under review.
Well, the Department of Water Resources, after the ugly surprise of extremely erodible material under the main spillway and the emergency spillway, wants dam owners throughout the state to look at these 93 spillways, actually, to make sure that they're sound and can take overflows.
Dan Brecke is transportation and infrastructure reporter for KQED in San Francisco. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I guess if you want more information, you could screen Chinatown, the old movie, during the break. We're going to take a break. And what if you could hold your smartphone up to your ear and unlock it with the unique shape of your ear print? That is possible. Biometrics way beyond the fingerprint. We're going to talk about all different ways that we're thinking about using body parts to keep your privacy intact. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Your fingerprints are all over your phone, right? If you're like me, that unique physical marker can be used to unlock your smartphone, too. But if it's not foolproof technology, because security researchers have already shown that you can unlock devices with a replica of someone's fingerprint. They say that they can even swipe fingerprint data from a photo of someone flashing the peace sign. Wow. So, okay, why not use then an iris scan? Consider the case where a hacker used a poster of German Chancellor Angela Merkel to extract iris information from her eye, which the hacker said he could print on a contact lens. to spoof an iris scanner. You get the point here. As more biometric tech comes online, like 3D face scanning in your next iPhone, perhaps, how can we make our machines savvy enough to know the real thing from a spoof? Stephanie Shuckers, director of the Center for Identification Technology Research and a professor at Clarkson University in Potsdam, New York, is here. She joins us from WILL in Illinois. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
April, you're welcome. April Glazer is a technology staff writer at Slate. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
April, let's start off with fingerprint scanning, facial recognition. They're all pretty widely used, but there are some less conventional biometrics on the horizon, ones people may not have heard so much about, right? What are they? Go through a little list of them for us.
Well, you mentioned at the beginning the ear scan. There is a company in the Pacific Northwest that can scan for the unique shape of an earlobe, and that is apparently a unique identifier that that none of us share, is the shape of our earlobe. And that is apparently, according to some reporting that I did last year, was being tested by some police forces, some police departments in Washington State. And they put the tech, say, in a body-mounted camera. So that way, when the police came up to the person's window, they could see someone's ear and then match that to a database. MasterCard has been experimenting with selfie recognition. So you take a picture of yourself, and so that's more facial recognition. We also have seen heartbeat monitoring. So these are bracelets that you wear. Microsoft also experimented with this in 2015, where you actually check out and pay with your financial information linked to your unique heartbeat. There's eye vein scanning, right? So it goes well beyond the finger.
Dr. Shuckers, anything you want to add to where we're headed?
Yes. Some of the other modalities that we could look at are veins. So we can look at beyond the veins of your eye, the veins in your finger, the veins in your wrist, the veins in your palm. Each of these can be used as a unique identifier. I've even seen the electroencephalogram. So this would be electrodes placed on your head. Could be used as an identifier, which might be good for wearables, headphones, et cetera.
Now, it has been rumored that the next iPhone might have a 3D facial recognition. We don't know, but as you say, as April said, there's 3D, facial recognition already. How secure is that? Can't people hack facial recognition already?
Yes, definitely. And so what you want to do is when you measure the biometric, you also want to measure additional features that really tell you that you're measuring it from a real person, not just a photograph or someone holding up a phone of a photograph of an individual. And we call that liveness detection.
Liveness detection. And what other things would it incorporate? Would you put your fingerprint and your face on there? Or?
Well, what's neat about the 3D face, for example, is now any two-dimensional representation of a face, like a photograph, wouldn't work anymore because you would need that three-dimensional information. So that could be an example. Mm-hmm. Other examples might be looking in the near-infrared range, because obviously you have different information present in your face in the near-infrared range than you would in a typical visible spectrum photograph.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that seems so fundamentally different about biometrics as opposed to passwords is that I don't go walking around with my password written on my shirt, but my face is out there. My iris data or fingerprints can be swiped from photographs. Everybody's getting their picture taken everywhere now.
Exactly, and that's what's neat about the liveness detection piece, because you can put the two of them together, and that's what you need to do the full recognition. To know that it matches what you've stored before in terms of the face features, but also that you just measured it from that individual and not from some kind of replica.
Mm-hmm. April, do you see any problem with any of this stuff?
I mean, sure, and you make a great point about the fact that a password is inherently private, right? And the whole point is that you don't tell anyone. And the same with a credit card, right? In the sense that you only have one and you have it. But yeah, when you walk around, your face is available to view. And it's true that a photograph can be a source of for biometric technology, and we see Facebook doing that, for instance, right? So when you put your photograph into Facebook, as do 350 million photographs that go into Facebook a day, those are all, you know, many of them, rather, are being read, and the faces are being read and put into their facial recognition database that they then use to match name to face.
Our number 844-724-8255, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry if you'd like to get in on this discussion. Now, I understand there are two kinds of biometrics, physiological and behavioral. Stephanie, what's the difference there, and is one better than the other?
They are different. The physiological is more the concrete aspects, like a fingerprint, right? Mm-hmm. It has a physical characteristic, where behavioral can change depending on your behavior, like how you walk, how you talk, how you hold something, for example, how you type, how you swipe on your phone. Those are all your behaviors that then can be utilized to create a signature of yourself and utilized for biometric recognition.
Mm-hmm. What about it being used, I'll ask both of you, what about it being used without my permission? I mean, if there's facial recognition on my cell phone, for example, and I'm stopped by a police officer, could he just not take my phone and point it back at my face and, you know, unlock my phone that way?
Yes, certainly. And I think that's where we're still in a national conversation about what are the limits, what is okay and what is not okay. And I think the public certainly is expressing their opinions on this. And it's really up to technology and government to listen in terms of, you know, what's the right balance between the security of your own devices, security of the country, and, of course, your own privacy.
April?
Yes, and, you know, there are a couple of states that have consent laws when it comes to facial recognition in particular, and those are Illinois and Texas. So, and in those states, or in Illinois in particular, you're supposed to consent to your face being, you know, matched to your name with, you know, using facial recognition technology. But in other places, they don't need to your consent at all. And that opens the door for such a wide range of uses, right, from advertisers to law enforcement. And we know that law enforcement, and the FBI in particular, has a massive facial recognition database that has mugshots, driver's license photos, passport photos, all kinds of things. And so certainly we're at a place now, whether or not you consent to it, in most states where if they do take a picture of you, they can use that to match to all kinds of records that they may have on you, whether or not those records are correct.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Shuckers, let's talk a little bit about, let's get into the weeds. We like to get into the weeds here about how the biometric data about me on my phone is kept secret and kept safe. Does it go out over Wi-Fi or my cell phone every time I authenticate my fingerprint, let's say in a banking app, for example, or any other way?
That's a great question, because this does get back to your comments related to privacy. The trend right now is to store your biometric data locally on the device, and most of the major mobile device companies have this capability in there. And so what happens is it's not really biometrics that's doing the authentication with your bank. It's really a two-step process. It's the combination of biometric for local user verification and asymmetric key cryptography for the verification with your bank. And a lot of this is being done under what's called the FIDO Alliance. That mm-hmm. stands for Fast Identity Online. Mm-hmm.
So is the password then a slow death here? Or are we always going to have passwords, do you think?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think we will have passwords for quite a while, because we need a way to be able to reset new devices. But I also think there's a lot of people working creatively to move beyond the password. The FIDO Alliance is the first step, which means now you're not storing your password mm-hmm. at your relying party and using it for every single transaction, which, you know, beyond mm-hmm. security risks, also is a convenience issue, right? Having to remember all these different passwords.
Let's go to the phones to Wayne in Georgia. Hi, Wayne. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Hey there.
I wanted to ask the question that you're all talking about, you know, passwords that are unspoofed. or not able to be. What about DNA? Because, see, that's something which that nobody would know except you and your technical devices.
Good question. Why not something you plug into your smartphone, a little chip, right, a biochip, and you put a piece of DNA on there?
Yes, I don't think we're quite there yet with DNA. DNA takes 45 minutes to an hour to process right now. So you might have to wait a while to get into your phone.
Now, that said, there are efforts right now to make smaller and more affordable ways to synthesize DNA and more portable ways. But, yeah, we're just not there yet.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know, April, you've written about an alternative to all of this, and that is instead of using your thumbprint or an iris scan to unlock a door, some companies just ask their employees to implant chips, little chips underneath their skin. Is that where we're all going with this?
Well, it's one direction that some companies have been exploring, particularly outside of the United States more, although U.S. companies are digging more into that. But the idea there is that a chip about the size of a grain of rice is usually inserted between the thumb and the index finger, and then that can be used to, say, unlock a door or turn on a coffee pot, right? And they use various types of wireless communication to do that. The issue there, though, is that, like any device, it can be potentially hacked, and a chip that's inside of you could read a lot of sensitive information, like where you are, where you're not, perhaps what devices you have around you or others, and therefore who you're mm-hmm. with, things mm-hmm. like that.
Let's say, Dr. Shucker, someone steals a phone. I'll put a politician's name on that, no real name, but it's a politician. Could they somehow get the raw biometric data off there, or is it secured on the phone in such a way that it's really hard to access?
Yes, they do take extra efforts to store the biometric information and the cryptographic information, and it's a special part of the phone, a secure part of the phone. That being said, I mean, really what we're trying to protect is scalable attacks that would be coming through the internet to your phone by doing that. If someone physically had your phone and had enough money and resources, I think, you know, anything could be hacked out of your phone. And so what we're more interested in is the sort of the broader scope of protecting your information in these scalable attacks.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International, talking about what's new in your cell phone and biometrics and all kinds of stuff with April Glazer and Stephanie Shuckers. Are we, you know, every time something new comes out about facial recognition or something with a chip or something like that, you know, I'm reminded of the Minority Report. And I remember where the star of the movie walks through a mall and everything, everywhere he goes, they instantly recognize who he is. They pitch ads at him. You know, are we there yet, April?
Well, we're getting there. And that can be done, to be clear, without biometrics. It could be done just by reading your phone, right, with beacons, and they can tell that you're around. But certainly retail shops are already using facial recognition software to, say, find repeat customers or identify shoppers. You know, perhaps even more creepily, we're seeing mobile phones now using eye gaze tracking for ad metrics, so they can see where your eyes actually land on the screen and then try to court your propensity to buy that product. And that could be seen as extremely manipulative. And, you know, we've seen billboards that change when someone drives past them, right? So we're seeing ads increasingly tailored to people as they walk through the world. And part of that does have to do with facial recognition and various biometrics. But a lot of that has to do with the fact that we're just carrying computers with us everywhere, and computers can talk to each other.
Is there any way to opt out of all of it? Can you talked about having a chip under your skin. Could you have a chip that says, I'm opting out all... You have no permission to do any of this stuff with me. Is that possible?
There's no universal opt-out right now like that, you know. So even if you're not on Facebook and people put, you know, your picture on there, then your picture's on there, and someone might be able to one day use that information. I'm not sure how, but to link that to you, right? You know, like we were saying earlier in the program, when your face is out there, it's out there. And if you have a driver's license, then your name is connected to your face. And there are thousands and thousands of security cameras in any city. And any of those cameras might be equipped with facial recognition technology. So unless you wear a mask all the time, I wish you luck.
Well, I only have a couple of minutes left to talk about it. But let me ask you what you see as the next biometric technology coming online. It's just around the corner.
You want to go?
Go ahead, Stephanie.
Please,
you can
please.
Go first.
I would say the behavioral biometrics, it's more now about not necessarily a single pressing of your finger or taking a photograph, but really just that your device knows you. It knows you by how you hold it, by how you work with the device, by how you swipe and type, and maybe other wearables you may have. So you don't really have to do anything. You pick up the device and it knows who you are.
So it's sort of like your friend.
Yeah.
That can't be so-and-so. They don't do that.
I would agree. I think that increasingly we're seeing companies take kind of a constellation of things that they can read about you, whether it's your gait or, you know, your fingerprint, your password, and using all of these things together to know that indeed that is you. The question then becomes, how is this going to be applied now that they know you're the one in the room? Are they going to tailor ads to you? Are they going to dig up your criminal history? These are the questions that remain unanswered.
Scary questions. It'll take a brave new world to deal with it. And let me thank my guest, Stephanie Shuckers, director of the Center for Identification Technology Research and a professor at Clarkson University in Potsdam, New York, April Glazer, technology staff writer at Slate. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, a look at the sweaty science of staying cool. You know, we're sort of unique in the animal world about sweating. A lot of animals just don't sweat. How do they stay cool? Why do we sweat? Don't sweat about it until you get back. We'll be right back after the break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The dog days of summer are here. And you know, that phrase is generally used to describe the hot, muggy days late in the season when even our four-legged friends don't have the energy to do anything except sit around and pant, just trying to keep cool. But I'll bet you didn't know that that phrase did not originate with dogs. It may have originated with Greek astronomy. Nevertheless, like dogs, many mammals pant to regulate their body temperature. Other animals like ectotherms, lizards, amphibians, and insects have to look to their environment for a cool, shady spot. And of course, we humans are in a category of our own. Believe it or not, we are the only mammal that relies on secreting water onto the surface of our skin to stay cool, to sweat. But how did we develop this ability? And when did we ditch the fur of our primate ancestors in favor of sweaty skin? This week, we're taking a refreshing dive into the world of thermoregulation. That means ways humans and animals evolved to beat the heat. Have you a question about adaptive behaviors for staying cool? Give us a call. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk, or tweet us at SciFry. Yana Kambarov is assistant professor of genetics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Kambarov.
Thank you, Ira. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. Rory Telemico is a postdoctoral scholar in the Department of Biological Sciences at Auburn University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Yana, let's talk about why furry animals have to pant to stay cool. What does that do for them?
Well, so panting, as you said, is something that furry animals do. And basically, all kind of cooling in mammals involves, to a large extent, the heat that's needed to convert water from a liquid to a gas and the energy that's lost in doing that. And so furry animals pant basically in order to take air in use that to dissipate body heat. They do it in their upper respiratory tract. In a horse, you know, that big snout that a horse has, you're getting evaporative cooling inside that big snout. And it's basically, an animal using convection essentially to evaporate water off of a surface.
It's like when you come out of the shower, you feel cold because the water is evaporating off of
you. Exactly. That's exactly right.
So what about our primate ancestors? Is that what they did also?
Well, so if we look at our closest primate relatives, chimpanzees, gorillas, if we even look beyond that into outside of the great apes and we look at macaques, for example, old world monkeys, we see that panting is the main mechanism by which they thermoregulate, by which they dump their body heat. And so it stands to reason that, you know, our ancestors, you know, our last common ancestor with the chimpanzee would also have panted. But something changed over the course of human evolution, perhaps having to do with the fact that we became striding bipeds and later evolved endurance running capabilities, which altered how we as a species thermoregulate and sent us down a very unique path. But so the idea is that, yeah, we probably very similar to a chimpanzee. Panting is a main mechanism to cool off is probably what our human ancestors did.
Now, you were talking about horses panting, but I mean, don't we all see horses sweating all the time also?
They do. So, right, exactly. So horses lather up. But so what's distinguishing about humans are not the only species that sweats, but it's the kind of sweat that we have, right? So as you said, we have sweat glands that secrete water onto the surface of the skin. Horses have a different type of gland. A lot of cursorial animals, actually, running animals, have this. They are called apocrine glands, and they are associated with the hairs on the horse's body. And what they secrete is not water, but it's actually rather a mixture of some water, some lipids, some fat, some protein. So it's not the same. It's basically it's a different substance that's being secreted. But the horse's main mechanism is going to be panting to
that
cool
is,
off.
I didn't know that. I always thought the sweating was.
It's
really
a different kind of sweating. Yeah, it's a different kind of sweating.
Now, Rory, your animals that you study don't sweat.
Correct.
What do they do?
Well, they have an entire suite of traits that they can use to cool off. Probably the foremost thing is selecting a cooler area or a warmer area and shuttling back and forth between them.
So
and
we're
humans will do that some too, going to shade and whatnot.
So we're talking about lizards and amphibians and insects and stuff like that.
Yeah, pretty much every animal other than a bird or a mammal. So even like nematodes will thermoregulate some.
Hmm.
Fish, yeah.
So they, I guess if for a lizard or an animal that lives in a hot, in a dry climate, sweating would be very disadvantageous because then you'd have to get the water back in your body somehow.
Correct. One of the sort of main evolutionary events that happened in the evolution of reptiles in particular and the sort of the land-dwelling amniotes was ways to retain water. So that's why they have that really heavy, thick, scaly skin is it enables them to retain water. They do still use evaporative cooling some. So if you really heat up a desert-dwelling lizard, as it starts to get towards its temperatures that are potentially dangerous, they'll open up their mouth to allow the membranes of the mouth, which are very wet, to have evaporation occur across them, which particularly cools the head down and allows the brain to cool off.
Interesting. So, Dr. Kamborov, why did we develop the ability to sweat instead of pant? What was the advantage there?
That's sort of a million-dollar question. So we actually can't pant because of sort of structural changes in the human body. You know, for example, we don't have that big snout that a horse is going to have, right? Our face is a very reduced snout. So there are a couple of hypotheses that exist as to why humans develop such a unique way to dissipate heat. It's one possibility is that it enabled us to basically explore a niche that was free of predators. So, you know, if you cool off the way a human does, you basically can go out during the hottest periods of the day. When most predators are going to be hiding themselves from heat, right? Because that they're going to stay out of the sun, essentially. We, on the other hand, are able under very strong radiant heat to just sweat, right? To cool ourselves off, kind of opens up an avenue for us to. We're not very fast, right? To go and exploit a niche that otherwise wouldn't be available. Another hypothesis is that. Basically, about 2 million years ago, really with the inception of the genus Homo, there is evidence that suggests that humans started to develop adaptations that made them good endurance runners. So we could do persistence running, persistent hunting and gathering, and that generates a tremendous amount of body heat, right? And so you need a way to dump that heat load. Now, if you're going to be running, you know, a horse at full gallop cannot pant. So its main mechanism for cooling off is not available because of, again, the sort of the way in which kind of the organs are going to push on the body as the quadruped is going to, a four-legged animal is going to slant forward. So again, your main mechanism isn't available to you. On the other hand, humans can run around at our full speed and still manage to cool off. So there's a hypothesis that this allowed us to exploit persistence hunting, for example, or cover, again, long distances in the hot midday sun in the sort of warm regions where humans first evolved.
Interesting. Meg tweeted us a nice picture of her cat. And wasn't, you know, a lot of cat pictures, but it's a nice question. She says, how do cats cool down? I read their paws can sweat a little, but my cat pants after a game of mouse.
That's right. So cats cool off by panting. But it is true that, so in, you know, again, humans have a very, very specialized kind of sweat gland. I mentioned apocrine glands, which exist in horses. Sweat glands, eccrine sweat glands, which are the glands that secrete water onto the surface of human skin, in virtually all other mammals outside of the closest primate relatives to humans, those glands are restricted to the bottom of the paws. In those, if you look at the bottom of your cat's foot, remember what you see is that thick pad, and then in between you see a bunch of hair. That thick pad is just chock full of sweat glands. And what those sweat glands are actually used for in this case is not for thermoregulation, but they're used for traction. So how much friction there is between the animal and the surface that it's walking on. So you can sort of think about when you have a dry palm and you try to just slide your palm across the surface, it sort of just skids. So you need a little bit of...
People spit on their hands before they...
That's right. That's right. Gives you a little traction. Exactly.
That's kind of interesting. Rory, we never think of insects as getting overheated, but can they get too hot for some insects?
Yes, they sure can. They have some of the highest thermal tolerances of animals. They can tolerate temperatures often into the upper 40s C, so they're getting around into the low 100s Fahrenheit. But they will overheat, and they'll break down just like any other animal if it gets too hot.
So when they break down, does that mean they just collapse and have to wait for it to get cooler, or does it kill them?
It depends on exactly how hot it gets. It will first cause them to basically just almost go into a torpor state. They look almost catatonic if you heat them up to just that point. And then if you cool them down, they usually can recover. But if you go just a degree or more over that, it will kill them.
Wow. That's true of butterflies, other insects?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yep, all of the insects. And butterflies are a neat example because they, a good ways below that, before they get that hot to where they just can't right themselves or do anything, they stop being able to really fly because their flight muscles exert enough heat.
How hot would that be in outside? What temperature would that be?
Upper 90s, low 100s.
Really?
Their body temperature gets that hot.
Then we're going to see a lot of that now, aren't we?
Well, potentially, right. But they still can behaviorally thermoregulate. So the first thing that would happen is they would adjust the sort of time of day that they're out flying or potentially whether or not they can go into a shady area, let their body cool down, and then fly some more. They also, when they're up in the air, are being able to cool through convection just by blowing through the air, which can help bring that down a little bit. But eventually, you're right, they will get hot enough that they have to land and stop feeding or stop ovipositing.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about sweating with Yana Kambarov and Rory Telemico. Let me ask you this, Dr. Kambarov. Recent research shows that too many tattoos can interfere with your sweat glands. Have you heard about that?
I've vaguely heard about this. Someone forwarded me the article. I haven't actually had a chance to look at it. I mean, it's in a way, it's not surprising. You're going to damage the skin a bit where the sweat glands live, and you might be damaging some of the vasculature, some of the blood vessels. You might be damaging some of the nerves that control sweating. That would argue that you shouldn't completely cover yourself in tattoos. That would be very bad if you're in a hot place.
And Rory, when speaking of hot, when it gets hot out, You know, we like to go jump in a lake or a pool or something like that. Is that what animals that can't regulate, like amphibians, is that what they do also? Why we see the, you know, frogs in the ponds and things like that?
Yeah, to some extent. The frogs have to stay in the water as well, just because if they dry out, they die. But being in the water helps, because as they're cooling, enough evaporative cooling happens just by sitting in a puddle, because the skin of frogs can shed water so readily that they're sitting there in their puddle. They don't dry out, but they're shedding water, allowing them to cool off, and they rarely will get too hot as long as they stay moist.
That's quite interesting. If we are sweating because we want to stay cool, what about the sweating we do when we get nervous? You know, sweaty palms, armpits.
Sweaty palms, exactly. So it turns out the way that those glands are innervated, so remember that the ancient condition, right, the ancestral condition, is sweat glands in the hands and the feet. And the way that those are innervated is actually different than the thermoregulatory sweat glands that are in the rest of your body that are primarily responsible for cooling you off, which sort of makes sense, right? You're not going to have, as Rory mentioned, a tremendous amount of convection when you're standing on top of your sweat glands, right? Mm-hmm. So exactly, when you get nervous, your hands start to sweat, and it's just the neurotransmitters that are the main activators of those sweat glands are different than the neurotransmitters for the rest of the body.
So they may have evolved a different way.
Ultimately the way to sort of, going back to your earlier question of when did all this happen and why did humans develop this unique system of thermoregulation, if we know what the genetic causes are for this, then we can actually date when it happened, right? If we know the genetic changes that are responsible for expanding sweat glands from being just on the bottom of the feet to being everywhere in the human body, then we can learn sort of when this occurred and have a sense of perhaps why it occurred in humans.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no. So the basic mechanism of how you build a sweat gland in the palm, right? There's got to be a kind of a basic mechanism of how the skin decides to build a sweat gland versus some other skin-derived organ like a hair, right?
Yeah.
But then there's, as you said, an extra layer that's going to be put on top of that, that this is a thermoregulatory sweat gland that's going to respond differently than sweat glands in the palms.
So in general, and summing up, sweating is a good thing then?
Sweating is a very, very good thing, and it's really, I'm going to go ahead and plug this. So there are studies that go back to the 1930s and the 1940s by Japanese scientists, which actually demonstrated that where you spend your first 2 years of life dictates how many of the sweat glands you're actually born with will become activated. So which makes it, so sweating is very important. So keeping your children purely in air conditioning is going to affect their ability to thermoregulate later in life. So it's important to sweat, to be exposed to heat, to sweat during those first 2 years of life.
Get the kids out of the house in the hot weather.
Get the kids out of the house, exactly.
All right. That's a great way to sum up. Thank you. That's all the time we have. Anna Kambarova is Assistant Professor of Genetics at the Perelman School of Medicine at University of Pennsylvania. And Rory Talamico is Postdoctoral Scholar in the Department of Biological Sciences at Auburn University. I think we learned so much about sweat. Didn't know that. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a good weekend. Charles Berquist is our director. Senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. I usually say don't sweat it, but it looks like sweating is good for you. So have a hot weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.